The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Good Old Days. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Good Old Days magazine. Good Old Days asked, what chores you had to do when you were growing up that kids don't do nowadays? Linda said she had mowing the grass with the old push mower. I would push it one pass and then have to flip it over to unstick the grass. It took a long time, but I would rather do that than wash dishes. And Vicky responded, ironing, back when clothes had to be sprinkled, rolled up, and put in the refrigerator before they were ironed. And then Lois said, hanging the laundry outside during the winter before Mom got a clothes dryer. Also, we had to scrub all the walls in the living room. Our first article for today is submitted by June Zarneski and is titled The Piano Room. I grew up in a typical Milwaukee, Wisconsin bungalow built in 1915. It had hardwood floors, a large front porch, and built-in china cabinets with glass doors in the dining room. But my favorite part of childhood was the room immediately to the right of the front door. This small room had a large rectangular stained glass window close to the ceiling at the far end. Underneath the window stood an old upright piano, refurbished by my dad. Is it any wonder we called this the piano room? In the days before radio and television, this special piano room was the entertainment center of the home. Back then, it was a status symbol to say a piano graced your home. Originally, our piano had been in my grandparents' farm home. When the farm was sold, the piano went into storage. In the 1960s, when my parents bought their first home, my grandparents offered them the piano. Of course, they gladly accepted since the home had a perfect spot for it. My dad rented a trailer and hauled the piano down from central Wisconsin. After cleaning it up, a mouse had made a home in it, and having a man come over to tune it, the piano was ready for use. I remember begging my mom to play it for us. My favorite song was Glenn Miller's In the Mood. I watched her fingers fly across the keys. She taught my sister and me to play Chopsticks and Heart and Soul as a duet. Our school offered affordable piano lessons, so we both signed up. Mom told us how, as a teenager, she had lessons from Liberace's aunt, who just happened to be a nun in her grade school. We saw the flamboyant Liberace on television and thought this was an amazing coincidence. But our piano was very special. It was a player piano. When my parents inherited it, my grandparents gave us loads of paper rolls stored in long, colorful boxes. The 12-inch wide rolls were like ancient scrolls with tiny holes punched in them. When a lever under the keyboard was pulled, a secret foot pedal door opened. Then you reached down and pulled the metal foot pedals out. After inserting a yellow QRS piano roll into the contraption behind the sliding panel doors on the front and hooking the roll's tab onto the cylinder, we placed our feet on the pedals and began to pump. The rolls were filled with songs like American Patrol, My Old Ohio Home, Ramona, Babyface, and Morgan Bladder Waltz, and plenty of polkas. At a local music store, we were able to buy modern rolls with songs like Where Have All the Flowers Gone and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Most of the rolls had printed words that ran along the edge so you could sing along if you didn't know the lyrics. When a roll ended, we had to rewind it. We turned a lever and began pumping. The roll went backward a lot faster than forward. We were always careful to slow our feet as we neared the end of the roll to avoid hearing that awful clatter as the roll spun wildly off the spindle. On beautiful summer days, I would sit down on the piano bench, which had a compartment underneath the seat to store sheet music, and reach over to my right and throw open the side window. I would glance sideways to look for neighbors to walk past. Hovering my fingers over the keys that moved up and down by themselves, I pretended to be playing. My hope was to give the illusion to passersby that I was a prodigy at the keyboard. I tried hard not to pump the pedals, obviously, in order to sustain my deception. However, I'm doubtful I ever tricked my neighbors with my stealthy talents. Home movies and photographs bear witness to the enjoyment that countless guests had visiting our piano room and pumping the old music rolls on the player piano. In those days, every Sunday was spent visiting with relatives. Aunts, uncles, and cousins inevitably vied for a turn to play a piano roll in our wonderful piano room. My cousins will still say, "I remember your house on Quincy Avenue and that player piano." As my siblings and I grew up and left home, the piano room grew silent. My brother still owns the house, and the piano still stands in that perfect spot. Although the pumps are broken and the keys out of tune, the piano patiently awaits the next chapter of its life. The next article I have for you, Pink Pearls of Wisdom by Sarah Etchen Baker. The scent of lavender perfume clung to Grammy like a well-worn shawl, a fragrance I associated with Sunday visits and the hushed reverence I had for her walk-in closet, a kingdom of faux furs, pearlized buttons, and meticulously hung dresses, each a relic of a life lived on the precipice of glamour. Grammy, you see, had been a hand model. Not famous, not exactly rich, but touched by the glow of a world I only glimpsed when flipping through her high-end fashion magazines. Beyond the glam and glitz and the garments of grandeur she had once worn, Grammy possessed a quiet, natural elegance and captivating grace. Even as she aged, she always wore an invisible crown, moving with an air of practiced dignity, her chin held high, each step slow and deliberate. Her porcelain hands were neatly groomed, not gaudy, and there was more beauty in the compassionate touch of her hands than in any printed image in a fashion magazine. Not only was Grammy a delicate woman, but she was also a creature of habit, regularly attending the biannual fashion show held in the Zodiac Room at Neiman Marcus, Dallas's premier high-end department store. One year, I, at the tender age of 10, was invited to accompany her. I felt special, believing I was now a lady-in-waiting or even a princess in the making, and Grammy was my mentor and maven wrapped in one petite package. That morning, I sat next to Grammy at her dressing table, silently watching her brush and style her luxurious bronze-brown colored hair. Before applying her makeup, she retrieved her Papier Poudre booklet and tore two thin sheets from it. "Papier Poudre is a beauty essential," she said, handing me one of the sheets. "Watch and do as I do. Gently pass it powder side down over your face. This will cleanse and refresh your skin, removing all facial oil and dust, leaving your face shine free and fresh. Ah, perfect. See? You'll be a lady in no time." She applied a thin layer of foundation to both her face and mine, and then dabbed and blended a soft pink rouge on both our cheeks, followed with a hint of facial powder. Before leaving her dressing table, Grammy applied a muted plum-colored lipstick to the graceful curvature of her tiny lips. "Remember," Grammy said, taking my hands in hers, "a lady never leaves her house without putting on her face. It's undignified." Grammy slipped into a yellow chiffon dress, draped a pink pearl necklace around her neck, and clasped the matching clip-on earrings into place on her ears. One other thing, she said as she took one last look at herself in the mirror. Jewelry should complement your outfit, not distract from it. Matching earrings are a must. Wearing my frilly, petticoated dress, which had been freshly starched and ironed, I followed Grammy to the garage where we boarded her newly washed and waxed Chrysler Imperial Crown. We made the drive to Neiman's in record time. As I stared at the luxurious, time-worn building, I imagined I was standing in a Paramount Pictures studio set. I lingered at its front doors, pretending Gina Lollobrigida, Anne Margaret, or even Rock Hudson would emerge from the set onto the street where I stood. "Are you coming?" Grammy tugged on my dress sleeve. "We mustn't be late for the fashion show." Placing my hand in hers, she said, "Now, honey bunch, walk with your head held high like you were made of magic." Together, we entered the department store, a temple of polished brass and the hushed whispers of salespeople. I paused momentarily, gawking at the exquisite crystal chandelier above me. I stood at the bottom of the store's signature double staircase, imagining Grace Kelly slowly descending it, wearing a glamorous floor-length gown, mink stole, and elbow-length gloves. Grammy and I floated from department to department, her gloved hand resting on my shoulder. We weren't there to buy, not really. We were there to observe, to absorb the atmosphere, to bask in the aura of elegance. We stopped at a rack of sleeveless dresses. "Now, darling," she began, her voice a low, melodic rumble. "Remember, a lady of a certain age never, ever wears sleeveless dresses." Her gaze swept over the bare arms of the mannequin, a dismissive flick in her eyes. "Skin loses its elasticity as you age. It sags and is simply unbecoming." I nodded, absorbing her truth. My 10-year-old arm suddenly felt vulnerable, anticipating time's inevitable betrayal. Next, we navigated the labyrinthine cosmetics department. "Never neglect your appearance," she instructed, her voice a soft whisper as she dabbed a sample of eye cream on the back of her hand. "Even if you're just popping out for milk, you never know who you might run into. Besides, looking your best is a sign of respect, both for yourself and others." Finally, it was time for the piece de la resistance, the fashion show and lunch in the Zodiac Room, a world of white tablecloths, tinkling silverware, and discreet waitstaff. The maitre d' seated us at a window table overlooking the city, the sun glistening off the skyscrapers like scattered diamonds. The room was teeming with fashionable women wearing pillbox hats, white gloves, tight-waisted dresses, and high heels. I watched models sashay from table to table, presenting the latest en vogue fashions. I inhaled the restaurant's hypnotizing aroma, one of delicately scented lace and expensive French sachets. I glanced across the room and thought I saw Audrey Hepburn and Sophia Loren sipping tea at a table adjacent to ours. A creamy tomato soup arrived, and Grammy took a small, elegant sip from her spoon. "Pay attention," she whispered, her eyes twinkling. "Never slurp your soup. It's unrefined." She then demonstrated a delicate dipping motion, the spoon barely grazing the surface of the soup before bringing it to her lips. I mimicked her, trying to emulate her seemingly effortless grace. I turned my head just as a pencil-thin model wearing a pair of tightly fitted capri pants and a sleeveless polka-dotted blouse strolled by our table. "What a delightful spring outfit. I'm too old to wear something that flashy," Grammy said with lament in her voice as she continued to nibble on her sandwich. After lunch, we walked arm in arm back to her Imperial Crown car, the magic of the day continuing to envelop me. A lifetime had passed since Grammy introduced me to the finer points of ladyhood. Her tidbits of wisdom stayed with me, They were precious gems, much like her pink pearls, that expressed her vision of the beauty and grace of womanhood. As I grew into ladyhood, I often wondered whatever happened to her pink pearls. Then one day, shortly after Grammy's passing, I received an unexpected package from my aunt. Inside, I discovered Grammy's vintage Chantilly lace shawl, which held the lingering lilt of her lavender perfume. I gingerly unfolded the shawl, and there, to my surprise, were Grammy's pink pearls. Taped to the lid of the box was her handwritten note to me. "I hope you enjoy wearing these pink pearls as much as I did. Remember, always be a lady." Our next story is submitted by Mary Barberio and is titled, "A Grand Lady in a Grand Old House." Enna, my dad's maiden sister, was my favorite aunt. She was one of four children born to Maria and Gustav, two adventurous, strong-willed people who left their homeland of Finland to settle in a small community in the northeast corner of Ohio, Ashtabula. Enna grew up resilient, determined, and some have said stubborn. Well, these qualities came to her aid as she worked her way up the ladder in her career in the banking industry. Some say she had to work twice as hard to prove her abilities over less competent male co-workers, but she persevered. Indeed, she was a woman ahead of her time, managing to maintain a career and still take care of her elderly parents. I have fond memories of visits with Aunt Enna and my Finnish-speaking grandparents, most centered around their big old house, the same house she and Dad grew up in. What a grand house it was. One of the many things I loved about it was the staircase. I have fond memories of my brothers and me grabbing some cushions, running to the top and sliding down to the bottom, giggling all the way. Then we'd race back to the top to do it all over again. But the focal point of the house was really the huge kitchen, where everyone would congregate and chat and drink coffee. Oh, how my relatives loved their coffee. You could find a pot brewing on the old-fashioned coal-burning stove just about all day long. Off to one side of the stove was a gigantic walk-in pantry where wonderful aromas of freshly baked nisua, a Finnish sweet bread made with cardamom, and recently ground coffee filled the air. I loved to go into that pantry and just inhale. Or now that I think about it, it was more likely that I went in to sneak a sugar cube. On the other side of the stove, over in the corner and right in front of a huge window, was Grandma's worn wooden rocking chair. Grandma would sit there and rock for hours, gazing out the window to watch the world go by. She spoke only Finnish, and I knew only a bit of Finnish, so we didn't talk much, but we got along just fine. A Finnish house would not be complete without a sauna, and sure enough, the grand house had one. Grandpa built it, and I had heard it was really nice. I didn't personally know that for a long time, though, as it was in the basement, and everyone knows dark basements can be scary. When I was little, I wouldn't even put one foot on the steps to that basement. My older brother had frightened me with stories of boogeymen living down there, and the coal-burning furnace made enough noise to convince me it was so. One day, Aunt Enna tried to talk some common sense into my little head. She pointed out that folks went downstairs and came back up without a problem all the time. Grandpa would go down to shovel coal into the furnace, and others went down to take a sauna. So she held my hand, and down we went. Sure enough, I saw no signs of boogeymen. Aunt Enna said there was no reason to be afraid anymore. I nodded, although that furnace continued to make scary noises. Back in the kitchen, sitting around the big table, I listened intently as the elders told me of their youthful days in the Finnish winters when they would go from the hot sauna out into the cold snow. They said it was good for circulation and kept them healthy. There must be something to it because my dad never had the typical childhood diseases such as chickenpox, mumps, measles, or even colds. I believe he only had the flu once when he was older. The house was grand, and so was Aunt Inna. She taught me about persistence and dedication, about confidence and standing up for myself, about how to multitask and juggle many plates, and how to be a caretaker and be kind and generous. I'll never forget that she also taught me that I can face my own fears. After all, I made it back up from the dark, scary basement. And our next article is titled Going to the Dark Side by Janet Lagerlof. In 1967, I went to third grade in the small town of Sugar Grove in northern Illinois. My family lived on the east side of Ash Road. The kids growing up on the west side of Ash Road went to Big Rock School, the next town over. At the same time every morning, our buses met and turned in opposite directions. The kids in those windows looked like foreigners to me, heading off to some unknown land. I was sure nothing good happened on that side of Ash Road. At the end of my third grade year, my parents built a house just down the road a bit, but far enough to catapult me into the Big Rock School District for my fourth grade year. "I'm a Sugar Grove girl," I wailed to my mom. "This is never going to work." All summer, I stomped, pleaded, and practically howled at the moon. But no matter, that fall, I boarded the bus that went the wrong way. I sat next to a girl with brown hair and saw my former bus make its turn. When we arrived and the bell rang, all the strange kids raced to their classrooms while the principal showed me around. Mr. Bills was older than my Sugar Grove principal and shuffled slowly. The school was older, too. The wooden floors creaked as we walked along. This was never going to work. Mr. Bills introduced me to the lunch ladies and told me they were making Bunsteads for lunch. "The students love them," he said. But I had never heard of a Bunstead. Who were these people? This was never going to work. As we approached the fourth grade classroom, Mr. Bills told me his granddaughter was in my class. Her name was Debbie Lee, but I soon learned she went by Lee. Everyone was already in their assigned seat. They heard my steps creak all the way to mine. Mrs. Larson was our teacher. Each morning, she led us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Below the flag, she'd hung a picture of Michael P. Finley, an 18-year-old Marine from Big Rock who was fighting in the Vietnam War at the time. Mrs. Larson mentioned him often, and we loved to talk about him. He was the closest I'd come to knowing a real hero. As the year went along, the class grew to like Mrs. Larson more and more, but Mike McCree, the tallest boy in our class, liked her most of all. At the end of each day, he kissed her on the cheek before he got on the bus. Some of the kids teased him, but he would say, "Why not? She's a nice lady." The Bunsteads at lunch that first day were a lot better than I thought they would be. The recipe was Mrs. Scott's. She was one of the lunch ladies. The Bunsteads were wrapped in foil and heated in the oven. They were like our own little treasure chest that we got to open. Inside was a soft hot dog bun stuffed with hot tuna fish, sliced boiled eggs, and melted American cheese. The girl with brown hair I sat by on the bus that first morning was Sarah Moody. She went by Moo Cow and was also in my class. We sat together on the way home that day and many days after that. I don't know exactly when I became a Big Rock girl, but by the end of the school year I was. Maybe it was the day Lee laughed so hard at lunch that a noodle came out of her nose. Now, that's funny. I don't care which side of Ash Road you live on. Or maybe it was because of all the times the lunch ladies made those heavenly Bunsteads. Through the years, I tried to make Bunsteads, but they never came out as good as Mrs. Scott's until I finally got my hands on a copy of the original recipe. Then the ones I made were heavenly, just like the ones I had at Big Rock. However, if I had to choose one moment when things changed for me at my new school, It would be the day Mr. Beals shuffled into our room and told us that Lance Corporal Michael P. Finley had been killed in action. Unlike the other kids, I had never met him, but he was a part of me, and after all these years, he still is. Next, I have a really short story from the Bits and Pieces section, and this was submitted by Lee Neely, and it's titled, When There Were No School Buses. When I see a school bus on the road, I think of my father. He grew up in the country before the advent of school buses. A lot of people never graduated high school when he was young. Some of it was because of lack of transportation. There were no buses and few cars back then. My father did graduate high school due to great effort on his part. He lived in a boarding house in the nearest town, 8 miles away from home, in order to attend high school. He set pins at a bowling alley to pay for his room and board. It's no surprise, then, that when I wanted to quit school in my senior year, my father said, no way, no how. So I did manage to graduate as well. Next, I have some quotes from things my parents used to say. Steve Rombau of Messina, New York, says his dad always had a saying for something that didn't smell very good. That smells like the east end of a horse going west. Dan Cooper of Montgomery, Texas, says when his dad would find something particularly useful, he would say, well, that's as handy as a pocket on a shirt. And last, when the mother of Lee Carpenter of Landisville, Pennsylvania, would get tired of her child always being underfoot, she would say, go outside and blow the stink off you. Christmas has passed, but I thought this was interesting. This is the price of what some popular Christmas gifts cost in the 1940s and 1950s. A Shirley Temple doll, $2.95 to $5. A Monopoly board game, $2. Leather baseball glove, $2.50 to $5, and roller skates would cost you $3.50 to $6. Tinker toys cost $1 to $2. A man's basic tie was $1 to $3. Matchbox cars were 49 cents each, and little golden books were 25 cents each. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Lisa Maxwell, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138, and we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.